Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of All Quiet on the Western Front by Eric Maria Remarque. Translated by A. W. Wien. Narrated by Frank Muller. This work, copyrighted 1929-1930 by Little, Brown & Company, and renewed 1957-1958 by Eric Marie Remarque, is recorded by arrangement with the estate of Paulette Goddard Remarque. This recording is copyrighted 1994 by Recorded Books Incorporated. At the age of 19, Paul Boehmer leaves Plato and Goethe behind to enlist with his classmates in the German army of the First World War. They bring with them youthful ideas about life and romantic concepts of honor, battle, and defending the fatherland. 10 weeks of training sharply curtails these notions, but nothing prepares them for the horror of the first bombardment, for life in the trenches. And now, All Quiet on the Western Front.
This book is to be neither an accusation nor a confession, and least of all, an adventure. For death is not an adventure to those who stand face to face with it. It will try simply to tell of a generation of men who, even though they may have escaped shells, were destroyed by the war. Chapter 1. We are at rest 5 miles behind the front. Yesterday we were relieved, and now our bellies are full of beef and haricot beans. We are satisfied and at peace. Each man has another mess tin full for the evening, and what is more, there is a double ration of sausage and bread. That puts a man in fine trim. We have not had such luck as this for a long time. The cook with his carroty head is begging us to eat. He beckons with his ladle to everyone that passes and spoons him out a great dollop. He does not see how he can empty his stew pot in time for coffee. Tjaden and Müller have produced 2 wash basins and had them filled up to the brim as a reserve. In Tjaden, this is veracity. In Müller, it is foresight. Where Tjaden puts it all is a mystery, for he is and always will be as thin as a rake. What's more important still is the issue of a double ration of smokes. 10 cigars, 20 cigarettes, and 2 quids of chew per man. Now that is decent. I have exchanged my chewing tobacco with Kaczynski for his cigarettes, which means I have 40 altogether. That's enough for a day. It is true we have no right to this windfall. The Prussian is not so generous. We have only a miscalculation to thank for it. 14 days ago, we had to go up and relieve the front line. It was fairly quiet on our sector, so the quartermaster, who remained in the rear, had requisitioned the usual quantity of rations and provided for the full company of 150 men. But on the last day, an astonishing number of English heavies opened up on us with high explosive, drumming ceaselessly in our position, so that we suffered severely and came back only 80 strong. Last night we moved back and settled down to get a good sleep for once. Kaczynski is right when he says it would not be such a bad war if one could only get a little more sleep. In the line we have had next to none, and 14 days is a long time at one stretch. It was noon before the first of us crawled out of our quarters. Half an hour later every man had his mess tin, and we gathered at the cookhouse, which smelt greasy and nourishing. At the head of the queue, of course, were the hungriest. Little Albert Krupp, the clearest thinker among us, and therefore only a lance corporal. Müller, who still carries his school textbooks with him, dreams of examinations and during a bombardment mutters propositions in physics. Lehr, who wears a full beard and has a preference for the girls from officers' brothels, he swears that they are obliged by an army order to wear silk chemises and to bathe before entertaining guests of the rank of captain and upwards. And as the fourth, myself, Paul Boehmer. All 4 are 19 years of age, and all 4 joined up from the same class as volunteers for the war. Close behind us were our friends, Tjaden, the skinny locksmith of our own age, the biggest eater of the company. He sits down to eat, as thin as a grasshopper, and gets up as big as a bug in the family way. Haya Vesthus, of the same age, a peat digger, who can easily hold a ration loaf in his hand and say, "Guess what I've got in my fist." Then Datering, a peasant who thinks of nothing but his farmyard and his wife. And finally Stanislaus Kaczynski, the leader of our group, shrewd, cunning, and hard-bitten, 40 years of age, with the face of the soil, blue eyes, bent shoulders, and a remarkable nose for dirty weather, good food, and soft jobs. Our gang formed the head of the queue before the cookhouse. We were growing impatient, for the cook paid no attention to us. Finally, Kaczynski called to him, "Say, Heinrich, open up the soup kitchen. Anyone can see the beans are done." He shook his head sleepily. "You must all be there first." Chodin grinned. "We are all here." The sergeant cook still took no notice. "That may do for you," he said, "but where are the others?" "They won't be fed by you today. They're either in the dressing station or pushing up daisies." The cook was quite disconcerted as the facts dawned on him. He was staggered. "And I've cooked for 150 men." Krupp poked him in the ribs. "Then for once we'll have enough. Come on, begin." Suddenly a vision came over Tjaden. His sharp, mousy features began to shine. His eyes grew small with cunning. His jaws twitched, and he whispered hoarsely, "Man, then you've got enough bread for 150 men, too, huh?" The sergeant cook nodded, absent-minded and bewildered. Chodin seized him by the tunic. "And sausage?" Ginger nodded again. Chodin's chaps quivered. "Tobacco, too?"
"Yes, everything."
Chodin beamed.
"What a bean feast! That's all for us. Each man gets... wait a bit. He has practically two issues."
Then Ginger stirred himself and said, "That won't do." We got excited and began to crowd around.
"Why won't that do, you old carrot?" demanded Kaczynski.
80 men can't have what is meant for 150.
"We'll soon show you," growled Müller.
"Well, I don't care about the stew, but I can only issue rations for 80 men," persisted Ginger. Kaczynski got angry.
"You might be generous for once. You haven't drawn food for 80 men. You've drawn it for the second company." "Good. Let's have it, then. We are the second company."
We began to jostle the fellow. No one felt kindly toward him, for it was his fault that the food often came up to us in the line too late and cold. Under shell fire, he wouldn't bring his kitchen up near enough, so that our soup carriers had to go much farther than those of the other companies. Now Bulka, of the first company, is a much better fellow. He is as fat as a hamster in winter, but he trundles his pots, when it comes to that, right up to the very front line. We were in just the right mood, and there would certainly have been a dust-up if our company commander had not appeared. He informed himself of the dispute and only remarked, "Yes, we did have heavy losses yesterday." He glanced into the Dixie. "The beans look good." Ginger nodded. "Cooked with meat and fat." The lieutenant looked at us. He knew what we were thinking. And he knew many other things, too, because he came to the company as a non-com and was promoted from the ranks. He lifted the lid from the Dixie again and sniffed. Then passing on, he said, "Bring me a plateful. Serve out all the rations. We can do with them." Ginger looked sheepish as Chodin danced round him.
"It doesn't cost you anything. Anyone would think the quartermaster's store belonged to him. And now get on with it, you old blubber sticker, and don't you miscount either." "You be hanged," spat out Ginger.
When things get beyond him, he throws up the sponge altogether. He just goes to pieces. And as if to show that all things were equal to him, of his own free will, he issued in addition half a pound of synthetic honey to each man. Today is wonderfully good. The mail has come, and almost every man has a few letters and papers. We stroll over to the meadow behind the billets. Krupp has the round lid of a margarine tub under his arm. On the right side of the meadow, a large common latrine has been built, a roofed and durable construction. But that is for recruits, who as yet have not learned how to make the most of whatever comes their way. We want something better. Scattered about everywhere, there are separate, individual boxes for the same purpose. They are square, neat boxes with wooden sides all round, and have unimpeachably satisfactory seats. On the sides are hand grips, enabling one to shift them about. We move three together in a ring and sit down comfortably. And it will be 2 hours before we get up again. I well remember how embarrassed we were as recruits in barracks when we had to use the general latrine. There were no doors, and 20 men sat side by side as in a railway carriage, so that they could be reviewed all at one glance, for soldiers must always be under supervision. Since then we have learned better than to be shy about such trifling immodesties. In time, things far worse than that came easy to us. Here in the open air, though, the business is entirely a pleasure. I no longer understand why we should always have shied at these things before. They are, in fact, just as natural as eating and drinking. We might perhaps have paid no particular attention to them had they not figured so large in our experience, nor been such novelties to our minds. To the old hands they had long been a mere matter of course. The soldier is on friendlier terms than other men with his stomach and intestines. 3/4 of his vocabulary is derived from these regions, and they give an intimate flavor to expressions of his greatest joy as well as of his deepest indignation. It is impossible to express oneself in any other way so clearly and pithily. Our families and our teachers will be shocked when we go home, but here it is the universal language. Enforced publicity has, in our eyes, restored the character of complete innocence to all these things. More than that, they are so much a matter of course that their comfortable performance is fully as much enjoyed as the playing of a safe, top-running flush. Not for nothing was the word latrine rumor invented. These places are the regimental gossip shop and common rooms. We feel ourselves, for the time being, better off than in any palatial white-tiled convenience. There it can only be hygienic. Here it is beautiful. These are wonderfully carefree hours. Over us is the blue sky. On the horizon float the bright yellow sunlit observation balloons and the many little white clouds of the anti-aircraft shells. Often they rise in a sheaf as they follow after an airman. We hear the muffled rumble of the front only as very distant thunder. Bumblebees droning by quite drown it. Around us stretches the flowery meadow. The grasses sway their tall spears. The white butterflies flutter around and float on the soft, warm wind of the late summer. We read letters and newspapers and smoke. We take off our caps and lay them down beside us. The wind plays with our hair. It plays with our words and thoughts. The 3 boxes stand in the midst of the glowing red field poppies. We set the lid of the margarine tub on our knees and so have a good table for a game of scat. Krop has the cards with him. After every misère ouverte, we have a round of nap. One could sit like this forever. The notes of an accordion float across from the billets. Often we lay aside the cards and look about us. One of us will say, "Well, boys," or, "It was a near thing that time." And for a moment we fall silent. There is in each of us a feeling of constraint. We are all sensible of it. It needs no words to communicate it. It might easily have happened that we should not be sitting here on our boxes today. It came damn near to that. And so everything is new and brave. Red poppies and good food. Cigarettes and summer breeze. Krop asks, "Anyone seen Kemmerick lately?" "He's up at St. Joseph's," I tell him. Müller explains that he has a flesh wound in his thigh, a good blighty. We decide to go and see him this afternoon. Krop pulls out a letter. "Cantorek sends you all his best wishes." We laugh. Müller throws his cigarette away and says, "I wish he was here." Catterick had been her schoolmaster, a stern little man in a grey tailcoat with a face like a shrew mouse. He was about the same size as Corporal Himmelstoss, the terror of Klosterberg. It is very queer that the unhappiness of the world is so often brought on by small men. They are so much more energetic and uncompromising than the big fellows. I have always taken good care to keep out of sections with small company commanders. They are mostly confounded little martinets. During drill time, Cantorek gave us long lectures until the whole of our class went under his shepherding to the district commandant and volunteered. I can see him now, as he used to glare at us through his spectacles and say in a moving voice, "Won't you join up, comrades?" These teachers always carry their feelings ready in their waistcoat pockets and trot them out by the hour. But we didn't think of that then. There was indeed one of us who hesitated and did not want to fall into line. That was Joseph Bame, a plump, homely fellow. But he did allow himself to be persuaded, otherwise he would have been ostracized. And perhaps more of us thought as he did, but no one could very well stand out. Because at that time even one's parents were ready with the word coward. No one had the vaguest idea what we were in for. The wisest were just the poor and simple people. They knew the war to be a misfortune, whereas those who were better off and should have been able to see more clearly what the consequences would be were beside themselves with joy. Kaczynski said that was a result of their upbringing. It made them stupid. And what Katz said, he had thought about. Strange to say, Bame was one of the first to fall. He got hit in the eye during an attack, and we left him lying for dead. We couldn't bring him with us because we had to come back helter-skelter. In the afternoon, suddenly we heard him call, and saw him crawling about in no man's land. He had only been knocked unconscious. Because he could not see and was mad with pain, he failed to keep under cover, and so was shot down before anyone could go and fetch him in. Naturally, we couldn't blame Cantorek for this. Where would the world be if one brought every man to book? There were thousands of Cantoreks, all of whom were convinced that they were acting for the best, in a way that cost them nothing. And that is why they let us down so badly. For us lads of 18, they ought to have been mediators and guides to the world of maturity, the world of work, of duty, of culture, of progress to the future. We often made fun of them and played jokes on them, but in our hearts we trusted them. The idea of authority which they represented was associated in our minds with a greater insight and a more humane wisdom. But the first death we saw shattered this belief. We had to recognize that our generation was more to be trusted than theirs. They surpassed us only in phrases and in cleverness. The first bombardment showed us our mistake, and under it the world as they had taught it to us broke in pieces. While they continued to write and talk, we saw the wounded and dying. While they taught that duty to one's country is the greatest thing, we already knew that death throes are stronger. But for all that, we were no mutineers, no deserters, no cowards. They were very free with all these expressions. We loved our country as much as they. We went courageously into every action, but also we distinguished the false from true. We had suddenly learned to see. And we saw that there was nothing of their world left. We were all at once terribly alone. And alone we must see it through. Before going over to see Kemmerich, we pack up his things. He will need them on the way back. In the dressing station there was great activity. It reeks, as ever, of carbolic pus and sweat. We are accustomed to a good deal in the billets, but this makes us feel faint. We ask for Kemmerich. He lies in a large room and receives us with feeble expressions of joy and helpless agitation. While he was unconscious, someone had stolen his watch. Müller shakes his head. I always told you that nobody should carry as good a watch as that. Müller is rather crude and tactless. Otherwise he would hold his tongue, for anybody can see that Kemmerich will never come out of this place again. Whether he finds his watch or not will make no difference. At the most, one will only be able to send it to his people.
How goes it, Franz?
Asks Krupp.
Kemmerich's head sinks. Not so bad. But I have such a damn pain in my foot.
We look at his bed covering. His leg lies under a wire basket. The bed covering arches over it. I kick Müller on the shin, for he is just about to tell Kemmerich what the orderlies told us outside, that Kemmerich has lost his foot. A leg is amputated. He looks ghastly, yellow and wan. In his face there are already the strained lines that we know so well. We have seen them now hundreds of times. They are not so much lines as marks. Under the skin, the life no longer pulses. It has already pressed out the boundaries of the body. Death is working through from within. It already has command in the eyes. Here lies our comrade, Kemmerich, who a little while ago was roasting horse flesh with us and squatting in the shell holes. He it is still, and yet it is not he any longer. His features have become uncertain and faint, like a photographic plate from which two pictures have been taken. Even his voice sounds like ashes. I think of the time when we went away. His mother, a good plump matron, brought him to the station. She wept continually. Her face was bloated and swollen. Kemmerich felt embarrassed, for she was the least composed of all. She simply dissolved into fat and water. Then she caught sight of me and took hold of my arm again and again and implored me to look after Franz out there. Indeed, he did have a face like a child, and such frail bones that after 4 weeks pack-carrying he already had flat feet. But how can a man look after anyone in the field?
"Now you will soon be going home," says Krupp. "You would have had to wait at least 3 or 4 months for your leave."
Kemmerich nods. I cannot bear to look at his hands. They are like wax. Under the nails is the dirt of the trenches. It shows through blue-black like poison. It strikes me that these nails will continue to grow like lean, fantastic cellar plants long after Kemmerich breathes no more. I see the picture before me. They twist themselves into corkscrews and grow and grow, and with them the hair on the decaying skull, just like grass in a good soil, just like grass. How can it be possible? Müller leans over. "We've brought you your things, Franz." Kemmerich signs with his hands. "Put them under the bed." Müller does so. Kemmerich starts on again about the watch. How can one calm him without making him suspicious? Müller reappears with a pair of airman's boots. They are fine English boots of soft yellow leather which reach to the knees and lace up all the way. They are things to be coveted. Müller is delighted at the sight of them. He matches their soles against his own clumsy boots and says, "Will you be taking them with you then, Franz?" We all three have the same thought. Even if he should get better, he would be able to use only one. They are no use to him. But as things are now, it is a pity that they should stay here. The orderlies will, of course, grab them as soon as he is dead. "Won't you leave them with us?" Müller repeats. Kemmerich doesn't want to. They are his most prized possessions.
"Well, we could exchange," suggests Müller again. "Out here one can make some use of them."
Still, Kemmerich is not to be moved. I tread on Müller's foot. Reluctantly, he puts the fine boots back again under the bed. We talk a little more and then take our leave.
"Cheerio, Franz."
I promise him to come back in the morning. Müller talks of doing so, too. He is thinking of the lace-up boots and means to be on the spot. Kemmerich groans. He is feverish. We get hold of an orderly outside and ask him to give Kemmerich a dose of morphia. He refuses.
"If we were to give morphia to everyone, we would have to have tubs full..."
"You only attend to officers properly," says Krupp viciously.
I hastily intervene and give him a cigarette. He takes it. "Are you usually allowed to give it, then?" I ask him. He is annoyed. "If you don't think so, then why do you ask?" I press a few more cigarettes into his hand. "Do us the favor."
"Well, all right," he says.
Krupp goes in with him. He doesn't trust him and wants to see. We wait outside. Müller returns to the subject of the boots.
"They would fit me perfectly. In these boots, I get blister after blister. Do you think he will last until tomorrow after drill?"
"If he passes out in the night, we know where the boots..."
Krupp returns. "Do you think..."
he asks.
"Done for," says Müller emphatically.
We go back to the huts. I think of the letter that I must write tomorrow to Kemmerich's mother. I am freezing. I could do with a tot of rum. Müller pulls up some grass and chews it. Suddenly, little Krupp throws his cigarette away, stamps on it savagely, and looking around him with a broken and distracted face, stammers, "Damn shit! The damn shit!"
We walk on for a long time. Krupp has calmed himself.
We understand. He saw red. Out there, every man gets like that sometime.
"What has Kantorek written to you?"
Müller asks him. He laughs.
"We are the Iron Youth."
We all three smile bitterly. Krupp rails. He is glad that he can speak.
"Yes, that's the way they think, these 100,000 Kantoreks. Iron Youth. Youth, we are none of us more than 20 years old, but young? Youth? That is long ago. We are old folk."
Chapter 2. It is strange to think that at home, in the drawer of my writing table, there lies the beginning of a play called Saul, and a bundle of poems. Many an evening I've worked over them. We all did something of the kind, but that has become so unreal to me I cannot comprehend it anymore. Our early life is cut off from the moment we came here, and that without our lifting a hand. We often try to look back on it and to find an explanation, but never quite succeed. For us young men of 20, everything is extraordinarily vague. For Krupp, Müller, Lear, and for me, for all of us whom Kantorek calls the Iron Youth. All the older men are linked up with their previous life. They have wives, children, occupations, and interests. They have a background which is so strong that the war cannot obliterate it. We young men of 20, however, have only our parents, and some, perhaps, a girl. That is not much. For at our age, the influence of parents is at its weakest, and girls have not yet got a hold over us. Besides this, there was little else. Some enthusiasm, a few hobbies, and our school. Beyond this, our life did not extend. And of this, nothing remains. Kantorek would say that we stood on the threshold of life. And so it would seem. We had as yet taken no root. The war swept us away. For the others, the older men, it is but an interruption. They are able to think beyond it. We, however, have been gripped by it and do not know what the end may be. We know only that in some strange and melancholy way we have become a wasteland. All the same, we are not often sad. Though Müller would be delighted to have Kemmerich's boots, he is really quite as sympathetic as another who could not bear to think of such a thing for grief. He merely sees things clearly. Were Kemmerich able to make any use of the boots, then Müller would rather go barefoot over barbed wire than scheme how to get hold of them. But as it is, the boots are quite inappropriate to Kemmerich's circumstances, whereas Müller can make good use of them. Kemmerich will die. It is immaterial who gets them. Why, then, should Müller not succeed to them? He has more right than a hospital orderly. When Kemmerich is dead, it will be too late. Therefore, Müller is already on the watch. We have lost all sense of other considerations because they are artificial. Only the facts are real and important for us, and good boots are scarce. Once it was different. When we went to the district commandant to enlist, we were a class of 20 young men, many of whom proudly shaved for the first time before going to the barracks. We had no definite plans for our future. Our thoughts of a career and occupation were as yet of too unpractical a character to furnish any scheme of life. We were still crammed full of vague ideas which gave to life, and to the war also, an ideal and almost romantic character. We were trained in the army for 10 weeks, and in this time more profoundly influenced than by 10 years at school. We learned that a bright button is weightier than 4 volumes of Schopenhauer. At first astonished, then embittered, and finally indifferent, we recognize that what matters is not the mind, but the boot brush, not intelligence, but the system, not freedom, but drill. We became soldiers with eagerness and enthusiasm, but they have done everything to knock that out of us. After 3 weeks it was no longer incomprehensible to us that a braided postman should have more authority over us than had formerly our parents, our teachers, and the whole gamut of culture from Plato to Goethe. With our young, awakened eyes we saw that the classical conception of the fatherland held by our teachers resolved itself here into a renunciation of personality such as one would not ask of the meanest servants. Salutes, springing to attention, parade marches, presenting arms, right wheel, left wheel, clicking the heels, insults, and 1,000 pettifogging details. We had fancied our task would be different, only to find we were to be trained for heroism as though we were circus ponies. But we soon accustomed ourselves to it. We learned, in fact, that some of these things were necessary, but the rest merely show. Soldiers have a fine nose for such distinctions. By 3s and 4s our class was scattered over the platoons amongst Frisian fishermen, peasants, and laborers with whom we soon made friends. Krupp, Müller, Kemmerich, and I went to No. 9 platoon under Corporal Himmelstoss. He had the reputation of being the strictest disciplinarian in the camp and was proud of it. He was a small, undersized fellow with a foxy, waxed mustache who had seen 12 years' service and was, in civil life, a postman. He had a special dislike of Krupp, Tjaden, Vesthus, and me because he sensed a quiet defiance. I have remade his bed 14 times in one morning. Each time he had some fault to find and pulled it to pieces. I have kneaded a pair of prehistoric boots that were as hard as iron for 20 hours, with intervals, of course, until they became as soft as butter and not even Himmelstoss could find anything more to do to them. Under his orders I have scrubbed out the corporal's mess with a toothbrush. Krupp and I were given the job of clearing the barrack square of snow with a hand broom and a dustpan, and we would have gone on till we were frozen had not a lieutenant accidentally appeared, who sent us off and hauled Himmelstoss over the coals. But the only result of this was to make Himmelstoss hate us more. For 6 weeks consecutively I did guard every Sunday and was hut orderly for the same length of time. With a full pack and rifle I have had to practice on a wet, soft, newly ploughed field the prepare to advance, advance, and the lie down until I was one lump of mud and finally collapsed. 4 hours later I had to report to Himmelstoss with my clothes scrubbed clean, my hands chafed and bleeding. Together with Krupp, Vesthus, and Tjaden, I have stood at attention in a hard frost without gloves for 1/4 hour at a stretch, while Himmelstoss watched for the slightest movement of our bare fingers on the steel barrel of the rifle. I have run 8 times from the top floor of the barracks down to the courtyard in my shirt at 2 o'clock in the morning because my drawers projected 3 inches beyond the edge of the stool on which one had to stack all one's things. Alongside me ran the corporal, Himmelstoss, and trod on my bare toes. At bayonet practice I had constantly to fight with Himmelstoss, I with a heavy iron weapon, whilst he had a handy wooden one with which he easily struck my arms till they were black and blue. Once, indeed, I became so infuriated that I ran at him blindly and gave him a mighty jab in the stomach and knocked him down. When he reported me, the company commander laughed at him and told him he ought to keep his eyes open. He understood Himmelstoss, and apparently was not displeased at his discomfiture. I became a past master on the parallel bars, and excelled at physical jerks. We have trembled at the mere sound of his voice, but his runaway post-horse never got the better of us. One Sunday, as Krupp and I were lugging a latrine bucket on a pole across the barrack yard, Himmelstoss came by, all polished up and spry for going out. He planted himself in front of us and asked how we liked the job. In spite of ourselves, we tripped and emptied the bucket over his legs. He raved. But the limit had been reached.
"That means clink!" he yelled.
But Krupp had had enough. "There'll be an inquiry first," he said, "and then we'll unload."
"Mind how you speak to a non-commissioned officer!" bawled Himmelstoss. "Have you lost your senses? You wait till you're spoken to. What will you do anyway?"
"Show you up, Corporal," said Krupp, his thumbs in line with the seams of his trousers. Himmelstoss saw that we meant it, and went off without saying a word. But before he disappeared, he growled, "You'll drink this." But that was the end of his authority. He tried it on once more in the ploughed field with his, "Prepare to advance! Advance! And lie down!" We obeyed each order, since an order's an order and has to be obeyed, but we did it so slowly that Himmelstoss became desperate. Carefully we went down on our knees, then on our hands, and so on. In the meantime, quite infuriated, he had given another command, but before we had even begun to sweat, he was hoarse. After that he left us in peace. He did indeed always refer to us as swine, but there was, nevertheless, a certain respect in his tone. There were many other staff corporals, the majority of whom were more decent, but above all each of them wanted to keep his good job there as long as possible, and this he could do only by being strict with the recruits. So we were put through every conceivable refinement of parade ground soldiering till we often howled with rage. Many of us became ill through it. Wolf actually died of inflammation of the lung. But we would have felt ridiculous had we hauled down our colors. We became hard, suspicious, pitiless, vicious, tough. And that was good, for these attributes were just what we lacked. Had we gone into the trenches without this period of training, most of us would certainly have gone mad. Only thus were we prepared for what awaited us. We did not break down, but adapted ourselves. Our 20 years, which made many another thing so grievous, helped us in this. But by far the most important result was that it awakened in us a strong, practical sense of esprit de corps, which in the field developed into the finest thing that arose out of the war, comradeship. I sit by Kemmerich's bed. He is sinking steadily. Around us is great commotion. A hospital train has arrived, and the wounded fit to be moved are being selected. The doctor passes by Kemmerich's bed without once looking at him. "Next time, Franz," I say. He raises himself on the pillow with his elbows.
"They have amputated my leg."
He knows it too, then. I nod and answer, "You must be thankful you've come off with that." He is silent. I resume, "It might have been both legs, Franz. Wegeler has lost his right arm. That's much worse. Besides, you will be going home." He looks at me.
"Do you think so?"
"Of course."
"Do you think so?"
he repeats. "Sure, Franz, once you've got over the operation." He beckons me to bend down. I stoop over him, and he whispers,
"I don't think so."
"Don't talk rubbish, Franz. In a couple of days you'll see for yourself. What is it, anyway, an amputated leg? Here they patch up far worse things than that. He lifts one hand.
Look here, though. These fingers.
That's the result of the operation. Just eat decently and you'll soon be well again. Do they look after you properly? He points to a dish that is still half full. I get excited.
Franz, you must eat. Eating is the main thing. That looks good, too.
He turns away. After a pause, he says slowly,
I wanted to become a head forester once.
So you may still, I assure him. There are splendid artificial limbs now. You'd hardly know there was anything missing. They are fixed onto the muscles. You can move the fingers and work and even write with an artificial hand. And besides, they will always be making new improvements.
For a while he lies still. Then he says, You can take my lace-up boots with you for Müller.
I nod and wonder what to say to encourage him. His lips have fallen away. His mouth has become larger. His teeth stick out and look as though they were made of chalk. The flesh melts. The forehead bulges more prominently. The cheekbones protrude. The skeleton is working itself through. The eyes are already sunken in. In a couple of hours it will be over. He is not the first that I have seen thus. But we grew up together. That always makes it a bit different. I have copied his essays. At school he used to wear a brown coat with a belt and shiny sleeves. He was the only one of us, too, who could do the giant's turn on the horizontal bar. His hair flew in his face like silk when he did it. Kantorek was proud of him, but he couldn't stand cigarettes. His skin was very white. He had something of the girl about him. I glance at my boots. They are big and clumsy. The breeches are tucked into them. And standing up, one looks well-built and powerful in these great drain pipes. But when we go bathing and strip, suddenly we have slender legs again and slight shoulders. We are no longer soldiers, but little more than boys. No one would believe that we could carry packs. It is a strange moment when we stand naked. Then we become civilians and almost feel ourselves to be so. When bathing, Franz Kammerick looked as slight and frail as a child. There he lies now. But why? The whole world ought to pass by this bed and say, That is Franz Kammerick, 19½ years old. He doesn't want to die. Let him not die. My thoughts become confused. This atmosphere of carbolic and gangrene clogs the lungs. It is a thick gruel. It suffocates. It grows dark. Kemmerich's face changes color. It lifts from the pillow and is so pale that it gleams. The mouth moves slightly. I draw near to him. He whispers,
If you find my watch, send it home.
I do not reply. It is no use anymore. No one can console him. I am wretched with helplessness. This forehead with its hollow temples, this mouth that now seems all teeth, this sharp nose, and the fat, weeping woman at home to whom I must write. If only the letter were sent off already. Hospital orderlies go to and fro with bottles and pails. One of them comes up, casts a glance at Kemmerich, and goes away again. You can see he is waiting. Apparently he wants the bed. I bend over Franz and talk to him as though that could save him. Perhaps you will go to the convalescent home at Klosterberg among the villas, Franz. And you can look out from the window across the fields to the two trees on the horizon. It is the loveliest time of the year now, when the corn ripens
At evening the fields and the sunlight look like mother-of-pearl. And the lane of poplars by the Klosterbach, where we used to catch sticklebacks. You can build an aquarium again and keep fish in it. And you can go without asking anyone. You can even play the piano if you want to. I lean down over his face, which lies in the shadow. He still breathes, lightly. His face is wet. He is crying. What a fine mess I have made of it with my foolish talk. But Franz, I put my arm around his shoulder and put my face against his. Will you sleep now? He does not answer. The tears run down his cheeks. I would like to wipe them away, but my handkerchief is too dirty. An hour passes. I sit tensely and watch his every movement in case he may perhaps say something. What if you were to open his mouth and cry out? But he only weeps, his head turned aside. He does not speak of his mother or his brothers and sisters. He says nothing. All that lies behind him. He is entirely alone now with his little life of 19 years and cries because it leaves him. This is the most disturbing and hardest parting that I ever have seen. Although it was pretty bad, too, with Tidian, who called for his mother, a big bear of a fellow, who with wild eyes full of terror held off the doctor from his bed with a dagger until he collapsed. Suddenly Kemmerich groans and begins to gurgle. I jump up, stumble outside, and demand, "Where's the doctor? Where's the doctor?" As I catch sight of the white apron, I seize hold of it. "Come, quick! Franz Kemmerich is dying!" He frees himself and asks an orderly standing by, "Which will that be?" He says, "Bed 26, amputated thigh." He sniffs. "How should I know anything about it? I've amputated 5 legs today." He shoves me away, says to the hospital orderly, "You see to it," and hurries off to the operating room. I tremble with rage as I go along with the orderly. The man looks at me and says, "One operation after another since 5 o'clock this morning. You know, today alone there have been 16 deaths. Yours is the 17th. There will probably be 20 altogether." I become faint. All at once I cannot do any more. I won't revile any more. It is senseless. I could drop down and never rise up again. We are by Kemmerich's bed. He is dead. The face is still wet from the tears. The eyes are half open and yellow like old horn buttons. The orderly pokes me in the ribs. "Are you taking his things with you?" I nod. He goes on. "We must take him away at once. We want the bed. Outside they are lying on the floor." I collect Kemmerich's things and untie his identification disc. The orderly asks about the paybook. I say that it is probably in the orderly room and go. Behind me they are already hauling Franz onto a waterproof sheet. Outside the door I am aware of the darkness and the wind as a deliverance. I breathe as deep as I can and feel the breeze in my face, warm and soft as never before. Thoughts of girls, of flowery meadows, of white clouds suddenly come into my head. My feet begin to move forward in my boots. I go quicker. I run. Soldiers pass by me. I hear their voices without understanding. The earth is streaming with forces which pour into me through the soles of my feet. The night crackles electrically. The front thunders like a concert of drums. My limbs move supple. I feel my joints strong. I breathe the air deeply. The night lives. I live. I feel a hunger greater than comes from the belly alone. Müller stands in front of the hut, waiting for me. I give him the boots. We go in and he tries them on. They fit well. He roots among his supplies and offers me a fine piece of saveloy.
With it goes hot tea and rum.
Chapter 3. Reinforcements have arrived. The vacancies have been filled, and the sacks of straw in the huts are already booked. Some of them are old hands, but there are 25 men of a later draft from the base. They are about 2 years younger than us. Krupp nudges me.
Seen the infants?
I nod. We stick out our chests, shave in the open, shove our hands in our pockets, inspect the recruits, and feel ourselves Stone Age veterans. Kaczynski joins us. We stroll past the horse boxes and go over to the reinforcements, who are already being issued with gas masks and coffee.
Long time since you've had anything decent to eat, eh?
Kat asks one of the youngsters. He grimaces.
For breakfast, turnip bread. Lunch, turnip stew. Supper, turnip cutlets and turnip salad.
Kat gives a knowing whistle.
Bread made of turnips? You've been in luck. It's nothing new for it to be made of sawdust, but what do you say to haricot beans? Have some?
The youngster turns red.
You can't kid me. Kaczynski merely says, fetch your mess tin.
We follow, curiously. He takes us to a tub beside his straw sack. Sure enough, it is half full of beef and beans. Kaczynski plants himself in front of it like a general and says,
sharp eyes and light fingers, that's what the Prussians say.
We are surprised.
Great guts, Cat. How did you come by that?
I ask him.
Ginger was glad I took it. I gave him 3 pieces of parachute silk for it. Cold beans taste fine, too.
Patronizingly, he gives the youngster a portion and says,
next time you come with your mess tin, have a cigar or a chew of tobacco in your other hand, get me?
Then he turns to us.
You get off scot-free, of course.
We couldn't do without Kaczynski. He has a sixth sense. There are such people everywhere, but one does not appreciate it at first. Every company has one or two. Kaczynski is the smartest I know. By trade he is a cobbler, I believe, but that hasn't anything to do with it. He understands all trades. It's a good thing to be friends with him, as Krupp and I are, and Haya Vestus, too, more or less. But Haya is rather the executive arm, operating under Kat's orders when things come to blows. For that, he has his qualifications. For example, we land at night in some entirely unknown spot, a sorry hole that has been eaten out to the very walls. We are quartered in a small, dark factory adapted to the purpose. There are beds in it, or rather bunks, a couple of wooden beams over which wire netting is stretched. Wire netting is hard, and there's nothing to put on it. Our waterproof sheets are too thin. We use our blankets to cover ourselves. Kat looks at the place and then says to Haya Vestus, come with me. They go off to explore. Half an hour later, they are back again with arms full of straw. Kat has found a horse box with straw in it. Now we might sleep, if we weren't so terribly hungry. Krupp asks an artilleryman who has been some time in this neighborhood, is there a canteen anywhere abouts?
Is there a what?
He laughs.
There's nothing to be had here. You won't find so much as a crust of bread here.
Aren't there any inhabitants here at all, then?
He spits.
Yes, a few, but they hang around the cookhouse and beg.
That's a bad business. Then we'll have to pull in our belts and wait till the rations come up in the morning.
But I see Kat has put on his cap. Where to, Kat? I ask.
Just to explore the place a bit.
He strolls off. The artilleryman grins scornfully.
Go ahead and explore, but don't strain yourself in carrying what you find.
Disappointed, we lie down and consider whether we couldn't have a go at the iron rations, but it's too risky. So we try to get a wink of sleep. Krupp divides a cigarette and hands me half. Tjaden gives an account of his national dish, broad beans and bacon. He despises it when not flavored with bog myrtle, and,
for God's sake, let it all be cooked together, not the potatoes, the beans, and the bacon separately.
Someone grounds that he will pound Tjaden into bog myrtle if he doesn't shut up. Then all becomes quiet in the big room. only the candles flickering from the necks of a couple of bottles, and the artillerymen spitting every now and then. We are just dozing off, when the door opens and Cat appears. I think I must be dreaming. He has two loaves of bread under his arm, and a blood-stained sandbag full of horseflesh in his hand. The artilleryman's pipe drops from his mouth. He feels the bread.
Real bread, by God, and still hot, too?
Cat gives no explanation. He has the bread, the rest doesn't matter. I'm sure that if he were planted down in the middle of the desert, in half an hour he would have gathered together a supper of roast meat, dates, and wine.
Cut some wood, he says curtly to Haya.
Then he hauls out a frying pan from under his coat, and a handful of salt, as well as a lump of fat from his pocket. He has thought of everything. Haya makes a fire on the floor. It lights up the empty room of the factory. We climb out of bed. The artilleryman hesitates. He wonders whether to praise Cat, and so perhaps gain a little for himself. But Kaczynski doesn't even see him. He might as well be thin air. He goes off cursing. Cat knows the way to roast horse flesh so that it's tender. It shouldn't be put straight into the pan. That makes it tough. It should be boiled first in a little water. With our knives, we squat round in a circle and fill our bellies. That is Cat. If for 1 hour in a year something eatable were to be had in some one place only, within that hour, as if moved by a vision, he would put on his cap, go out, and walk directly there, as though following a compass, and find it. He finds everything. If it is cold, a small stove and wood, hay and straw, a table and chairs, but above all, food. It is uncanny. One would think he conjured it out of the air. His masterpiece was 4 boxes of lobsters. Admittedly, we would rather have had a good beef steak. We have settled ourselves on the sunny side of the hut. There is a smell of tar, of summer, and of sweaty feet. Cat sits beside me. He likes to talk. Today we have done an hour's saluting drill because Tjaden failed to salute a major smartly enough. Cat can't get it out of his head. You take it from me, we're losing the war because we can salute too well, he says. Krupp stalks up with his breeches rolled up and his feet bare. He lays out his washed socks to dry on the grass. Cat turns his eyes to heaven, lets off a mighty fart, and says meditatively, "Every little bean must be heard as well as seen." The two begin to argue. At the same time, they lay a bottle of beer on the result of an air fight that's going on above us. Kaczynski won't budge from the opinion which, as an old front hog, he rhymes. Give them all the same grub and all the same pay, and the war would be over and done in a day. Krupp, on the other hand, is a thinker. He proposes that a declaration of war should be a kind of popular festival, with entrance tickets and bands, like a bullfight. Then, in the arena, the ministers and generals of the two countries, dressed in bathing drawers and armed with clubs, can have it out among themselves. Whoever survives, his country wins. That would be much simpler and more just than this arrangement where the wrong people do the fighting. The subject is dropped. Then the conversation turns to drill. A picture comes before me, burning midday in the barrack yard. The heat hangs over the square. The barracks are deserted. Everything sleeps. All one hears is the drummers practicing. They have installed themselves somewhere and practice brokenly, dully, monotonously. What a concord! Midday heat, barrack square, and drummers beating. The windows of the barracks are empty and dark. From some of them trousers are hanging to dry. The rooms are cool, and one looks toward them longingly. Oh, dark, musty platoon huts, with the iron bedsteads, the checkered bedding, the lockers and the stools, even you can become the object of desire. Out here you have a faint resemblance to home, your rooms full of the smell of stale food, sleep, smoke, and clothes. Kaczynski paints it all in lively colors. What would we not give to be able to return to it? Farther back than that, our thoughts dare not go. Those early morning hours of instruction,
What are the parts of the 98 rifle?
The midday hours of physical training.
Pianist forward, by the right, quick march, report to the cookhouse for potato peeling.
We indulge in reminiscences.
Krop laughs suddenly and says, Change at Lona.
That was our corporal's favorite game. Lona is a railway junction. In order that our fellows going on shouldn't get lost there, Himmelstoss used to practice the change in the barrack room. We had to learn that at Lona, to reach the branch line, we must pass through a subway. The beds represented the subway, and each man stood at attention on the left side of his bed. Then came the command, Change at Lona, and like lightning everyone scrambled under the bed to the opposite side. We practice this for hours on end. Meanwhile, the German aeroplane has been shot down. Like a comet, it bursts into a streamer of smoke and falls headlong. Krupp has lost the bottle of beer. Disgruntled, he counts out the money from his wallet. Surely Himmelstoss was a very different fellow as a postman, say I, after Albert's disappointment has subsided. Then how does it come that he's such a bully as a drill sergeant? The question revives Krupp, more particularly as he hears there's no more beer in the canteen. It's not only Himmelstoss. There are lots of them. As sure as they get a stripe or a star, they become different men, just as though they'd swallowed concrete.
That's the uniform, I suggest.
Roughly speaking, it is, says Cat, and prepares for a long speech. But the root of the matter lies somewhere. For instance, if you train a dog to eat potatoes, and then afterwards put a piece of meat in front of him, he'll snap at it. It's his nature. And if you give a man a little bit of authority, he behaves just the same way. He snaps at it, too. The things are precisely the same. In himself, man is essentially a beast, only he butters it over like a slice of bread with a little decorum. The army is based on that. One man must always have power over the other. The mischief is merely that each one has much too much power. A non-com can torment a private, a lieutenant a non-com, a captain a lieutenant, until he goes mad. And because they know they can, they all soon acquire the habit, more or less. Take a simple case. We're marching back from the parade ground, dog-tired. Then comes the order to sing. We sing spiritlessly, for it is all we can do to trudge along with our rifles. At once, the company is turned about and has to do another hour's drill as punishment. On the march back, the order to sing is given again, and once more we start. Now, what's the use of all that? It's simply that the company commander's head has been turned by having so much power, and nobody blames him. On the contrary, he is praised for being strict. That, of course, is only a trifling instance, but it holds also in very different affairs. Now, I ask you, let a man be whatever you like in peacetime. What occupation is there in which he can behave like that without getting a crack on the nose? He can only do that in the army. It goes to the heads of them all, you see. And the more insignificant a man has been in civil life, the worse it takes him.
They say, of course, there must be discipline, ventures Krupp meditatively.
True, growls Cat. They always do. And it may be so. Still, it oughtn't to become an abuse. But you try to explain that to a blacksmith or a laborer or a workman. You try to make that clear to a peasant, and that's what most of them are here. All he sees is that he has been put through the mill and sent to the front, but he knows well enough what he must do and what not. It's simply amazing, I tell you, that the ordinary Tommy sticks it all up here in the front line. Simply amazing.
No one protests. Everyone knows that drill ceases only in the front line and begins again a few miles behind, with all the absurdities of saluting and parade. It is an iron law that the soldier must be employed under every circumstance. Here Chaden comes up with a flushed face. He is so excited that he stutters. Beaming with satisfaction, he stammers out, Himmelstoss is on his way! He's coming to the front!
Chaden has a special grudge against Himmelstoss because of the way he educated him in the barracks. Chaden wets his bed. He does it at night, in his sleep. Himmelstoss maintained that it was sheer laziness, and invented a method worthy of himself for curing Chaden. He hunted up another pissabed named Kindervater from a neighboring unit, and quartered him with Chaden. In the huts there were the usual bunks, one above the other, in pairs, with mattresses or wire netting. Himmelstoss put these two so that one occupied the upper and the other the lower bunk. The man underneath, of course, had a vile time. The next night they were changed over and the lower one put on top so that he could retaliate. That was Himmelstoss's system of self-education. The idea was not low, but ill-conceived. Unfortunately, it accomplished nothing because the first assumption was wrong. It was not laziness in either of them. Anyone who looked at their sallow skin could see that. The matter ended in one of them always sleeping on the floor where he frequently caught cold. Meanwhile, Haya sits down beside us. He winks at me and rubs his paws thoughtfully. We once spent the finest day of our army life together, the day before we left for the front. We had been allotted to one of the recently formed regiments, but were first to be sent back for equipment to the garrison, not to the reinforcement depot, of course, but to another barracks. We were due to leave the next morning early. In the evening we prepared ourselves to square accounts with Himmelstoss. We had sworn for weeks past to do this. Tropp had even gone so far as to propose entering the postal service in peacetime in order to be Himmelstoss's superior when he became a postman again. He reveled in the thought of how he would grind him. It was this that made it impossible for him to crush us altogether. We always reckoned that later, at the end of the war, we would have our revenge on him. In the meantime, we decided to give him a good hiding. What could he do to us anyhow if he didn't recognize us and we left early in the morning? We knew which pub he used to visit every evening. Returning to the barracks, he had to go along a dark, uninhabited road. There we waited for him behind a pile of stones. I had a bed cover with me. We trembled with suspense, hoping he would be alone. At last we heard his footstep, which we recognized easily, so often had we heard it in the mornings as the door flew open and he bawled, "Get up!" "Alone?" whispered Krupp. "Alone." I slipped round the pile of stones with Tjaden. Himmelstoss seemed a little elevated. He was singing. His belt buckle gleamed. He came on unsuspectingly. We seized the bed cover, made a quick leap, threw it over his head from behind, and pulled it round him so that he stood there in a white sack, unable to raise his arms. The singing stopped. The next moment Haya Vestus was there, and spreading his arms he shoved us back in order to be first in. He put himself in position with evident satisfaction, raised his arm like a signal mast, and his hand like a coal shovel, and fetched such a blow on the white sack as would have felled an ox. Himmelstoss was thrown down. He rolled 5 yards and started to yell. But we were prepared for that and had brought a cushion. Haya squatted down, laid the cushion on his knees, felt where Himmelstoss's head was, and pressed it down on the pillow. Immediately his voice was muffled. Haya let him get a gasp of air every so often when he would give a mighty yell that was immediately hushed. Tjaden unbuttoned Himmelstoss's braces and pulled down his trousers, holding the whip meantime in his teeth. Then he stood up and set to work. It was a wonderful picture. Himmelstoss on the ground, Haya bending over him with a fiendish grin and his mouth open with bloodlust, Himmelstoss's head on his knees, then the convulsed striped drawers, the knock knees, executing at every blow most original movements in the lowered breeches, and towering over them like a woodcutter, the indefatigable Tjaden. In the end we had to drag him away to get our turn. Finally Haya stood Himmelstoss on his feet again and gave one last personal remonstrance. As he stretched out his right arm, preparatory to giving him a box on the ear, he looked as if he were going to reach down a star. Himmelstoss toppled over. Haya stood him up again, made ready, and fetched him a second well-aimed beauty with the left hand. Himmelstoss yelled and made off on all fours. His striped postman's backside gleamed in the moonlight. We disappeared at full speed. Haya looked around once again and said wrathfully, satisfied, and rather mysteriously, "Revenge is black pudding." Himmelstoss ought to have been pleased. His saying that we should each educate one another had borne fruit for himself. We had become successful students of his method. He never discovered whom he had to thank for the business. At any rate, he scored a bed cover out of it. for when we returned a few hours later to look for it, it was no longer to be found. That evening's work made us more or less content to leave next morning, and an old buffer was pleased to describe us as young heroes.